What I'd like to do today onwards at the beginning of this session is to do what's called a glance meditation, where you go through certain points and reflect on, for a short time, each of the points. And I'd like to do that with the Heart Sutra as a way of reflecting on, in particular, the topics that we've covered that day. So what I'll do is I'll guide you through I'll be reciting the Heart Sutra, and at certain points, based on what we've covered that day, expand a little bit on that, and then we can simply sit and reflect on that for a short time and then move on. So of course each day then we'll be reflecting on a little bit different section of the Heart Sutra as a way to familiarize ourselves with the Heart Sutra. So let's do that first. So you don't need to have the Heart Sutra in front of you, because you'll be just meditating on the words that I'm speaking. So as always, we begin by preparing the body, setting it into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. Allowing the body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. And letting go of all thoughts of the past or the future. Simply allowing the mind to come into the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. and while remaining in this quiet, clear, focused state, you can listen to the words of the Heart Sutra, allowing them to permeate your mind and reflecting on whatever meaning you can understand from these words. The heart of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, Arya Bhagavati Prajna Paramita Hridaya Sutra. Prajna Paramita, the perfection of wisdom, or the wisdom gone beyond to enlightenment, which is the realization of emptiness supported by bodhicitta. Hridaya Sutra, or Heart Sutra, containing the heart or essence of all of the Perfection of Wisdom teachings. Thus did I hear at one time. The Bhagavan was dwelling on massive Vultures Mountain in Rajgir, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. Try to picture that scene clearly. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, Arya Avalokiteshvara, looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Meaning that he saw that not only is the person empty of inherent nature, but also the basis of the person, the five aggregates, are also empty of inherent nature. Then, through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, Arya Avalokiteshvara. How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? Or in other words, how should someone who has developed great compassion and is inclined towards the Mahayana path, how should that person train in the practice of the wisdom of emptiness? He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Sharadvatriputra. Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this. Correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, likewise all phenomena are emptiness, without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. No visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element and so on, up to and including no mind element and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom. The mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly, completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as truth, since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared. Tayata, om, gate, gate, paragati, parasamgati, bodhi, svaha. Shariputra, The Bodhisattva Mahasattva should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage. It is like that. It is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan having thus spoken, the Venerable Sharadvatriputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, those surrounding in their entirety, along with the world of gods, humans, asuras, and gandhavas, were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. And then simply release all appearances and allow the mind to come to rest. To rest in the present moment. Simply resting in awareness itself. Without really doing anything at all. Without even trying to meditate. Without taking anything to mind, just rest. Just rest within pristine, pure awareness. So just before lunch, or just before afternoon tea rather, we saw that Avalokiteshvara's reply to Shariputra can be divided up into the various stages of the path to enlightenment. And we had a brief look at those stages of the path in that chart, the Mahayana path. And we saw that during those four or five stages or paths to enlightenment, we are deepening our understanding and realization of emptiness. And that if we really want to come to realize emptiness, meaning not just have some little taste of it, then we need a very stable, clear, and focused mind. For that experience to penetrate more deeply, to be more stable. And so what I'd like to do now is talk about this shamatha practice. How do we go about developing that very stable, clear, focused mind? Because unless we put some effort into this practice, then we can put a lot of effort into our vipassana practice, our emptiness practice. We can put a lot of effort into our compassion, loving kindness practice, all of our practices, and not really have much result. Because our mind is so distracted and dull, none of these practices really penetrate and are effective. So let's have a look at this shamatha practice now so that we can understand what it is and how to practice it and put some effort into this practice, so then we have a good basis for our emptiness practice and other practices as well. Now, as I said, as we saw the other day, is at all levels of practice, whether we're talking Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, we can really talk about these three core areas of practice of ethics, concentration, wisdom. So of course ethics is the foundation. And then concentration practice, concentration in Sanskrit is samadhi, and there are many levels of samadhi that we can develop in the spiritual path. And just to briefly summarize those so we have some idea about them. We can, in the meditation text, often they talk about 9 levels of samadhi that we can develop in the spiritual path. The minimum of those is called shamatha, and often translated into English as calm abiding. Calm abiding. Calm means our mind is not discursive, not a lot of activity. And abiding means we are focused on a single object. Above shamatha, we have 4 levels of concentration, which in Sanskrit are called the 4 dhyanas. And usually they're simply called the first concentration, second, third, and fourth concentration. Generally, in the Theravada tradition, when they talk about the concentration practice, they're often talking about developing these. In the Mahayana systems, often they mainly emphasize shamatha, because this is the minimum. But also in the Mahayana texts, they also talk about developing these 4 levels of concentration, because each one is more and more stable. But of course you have to put effort into developing each higher level. So of course it would be fantastic if we could develop the 4th level of concentration, most stable, but at least to have a direct realization of emptiness, at least we need this. Then above these 4, we have what's called the 4 absorptions. In Sanskrit, samapatti. These 4 absorptions, in terms of the spiritual path, are not that helpful, apart from being very peaceful, quiet state, because we're absorbing our mind so much that we don't that we lose the ability to investigate. So we can't really use these absorptions as a basis for Vipassana practice. Of course, there can be nice to sort of hang out there and be very peaceful. But in terms of using it as a basis for Vipassana practice, our mind is too withdrawn, too absorbed to be able to even start to discriminate and investigate. So these are usually the 9 levels that are talked about in the samadhi practice. And of course, at the time of the Buddha, many of the traditions at that time felt that this was the way to nirvana, that if we develop higher and higher levels of concentration, we'll eventually achieve liberation. Because as we develop higher and higher levels of concentration, of course, that level of concentration has a better and better capacity to keep the lid on the mental afflictions. So it seems like we're transcending the mental afflictions, but no, we're not. And so this is the way that Prince Siddhartha was first trying to get to liberation. But he found that this was like a dead end, that we need wisdom to eliminate afflictions. Concentration can merely suppress them or hold them down, but we need wisdom to actually eliminate them. So then he went on the basis of his concentration practice to do the Vipassana practice, the wisdom practice. So what I'm going to talk about now is how do we go about developing this shamatha, this single-pointed concentration. Now, with this practice, generally in the texts, it says there are 2 qualities we are trying to develop. Which are stability and clarity. So stability, of course, is to stabilize our mind, meaning we need a stable mind. We need to be able to focus on a single object without becoming distracted. So we have to stabilize the mind. But not only do we need a stable mind, we need a clear mind. We need to be able to focus on that object in a clear way. This is clarity. But I like to add a 3rd quality, which I think is very important in our modern day society, that wasn't so much emphasized in the original texts. And that is relaxation. Because many of us come into meditation from very hectic, stressful backgrounds. We tend to be very agitated and tense. And because our minds are so chaotic due to all the stimulus that we are bombarded by in our modern, fast-paced lives, then when we want to concentrate on something, we do it forcibly. We really are, often when we're quite concentrated, we're very tense. Because if we don't have that tension, then we just get distracted. And of course, if we only need to concentrate for a short time, that could work a little bit. But we know from our own experience, if we need to concentrate longer periods and we have this tension, we often get very tired and often become very agitated. So this approach is not going to work in Buddhism, in the spiritual path. We need to be alert and focused, but at the same time to be relaxed. So of course the fault that we're trying to overcome here is tension. So the first thing we need to do in shamatha practice is we need to learn how to relax. Because as a beginner, for many of us, the most common reason we have difficulties in our practice, in our meditation, is because we're too tight, too tense, we're trying too hard. And to really emphasize this point, I want to read from this book here called Attention Revolution by Alan Wallace. this is all about the shamatha practice. And so I think he really puts this very well. And this on page 14, if anyone has this book. And he's using as the example of focusing on the breath. That's one of the most common objects. He says, thus our practice of mindfulness of breathing consists of prolonging our awareness of our breath. While this requires an alert mind, such concentration should not be tense, but rather balanced. When we discover that we have become distracted from the meditation object, it may feel natural to clamp down more forcefully, tightly concentrating the mind. You can see this in the facial expressions of people who try to concentrate in this way. Their lips become pursed, their eyebrows draw together, and their foreheads become furled with wrinkles. They're becoming concentrated, but like orange juice, most of the fluidity is being drained from their minds. If you want to concentrate for a short time and don't mind the side effects of tension and fatigue, you can follow the above strategy. But if you want to follow the path of shamatha, you'll need an alternative. I had to discover this fact through experience. During my first extended shamatha retreat, I was filled with enthusiasm. I wanted to take full advantage of the rare opportunity that was before me, for I was meditating in India under the guidance of the Dalai Lama. I had no financial worries and my material needs were easily met. All I had to do was to put the instructions into practice. I threw myself into this training with all my might. Each morning, I would rise at 3:30, except once I slept in until 3:45 and got upset with myself for slacking off. Enthusiastic I was, but so uptight. The Tibetan manuals on shamatha meditation that I had studied over the years stated that the type of attention needed when one began such practice was, quote, highly focused. So I tried as hard as I could to keep my mind from wandering. Within a matter of a few weeks, devoting many hours each day to meditation, I could sustain my attention on my chosen object for up to half an hour. I was elated by making such fast progress. As the weeks went by, however, I found myself becoming more and more fatigued. I was draining myself both physically and mentally. My joy in the practice was diminishing accordingly, and I felt my attention was not developing any further. What was wrong? I was trying too hard. The cultivation of shamatha involves balancing the mind, and this includes balancing the effort exerted in the practice with relaxation. I think this points to a cultural difference between traditional Tibetans living in the highlands of Tibet and modern people living fast-paced lives, their senses constantly bombarded by telephones, email, media, and noise. Years of such existence condition the nervous system and mind in ways that might have been considered torture in rural Tibet. One traditional Tibetan doctor whom I know once commented on people living in the West. So now he's quoting the Tibetan doctor who says, from the perspective of Tibetan medicine, you are all suffering from nervous disorders. But given how ill you are coping remarkably well. Whether we dwell in Boston, Buenos Aires, Berlin, or Beijing, our minds are conditioned to be more high-strung and engaged in compulsive thinking than the minds of Tibetan nomads and farmers living a century ago. So when Tibetan meditation manuals advise beginners to focus their attention firmly, the instructions are aimed at a very different reader than the average city dweller in the 21st century. Before we can develop attentional stability, we first need to learn to relax. So I think this is a very, very important point, is the first thing we need to do is to relax, 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 both the body and the mind. Then, on the basis of a relaxed body and mind, we can work on stabilizing our mind. And so, of course, the fault here is distraction. Normally in the meditation texts, they list the fault as excitement, because excitement is the most common form of distraction. We are pulled away by something exciting, something better than what we're looking, focusing on. So stabilizing the mind means, of course, to be able to focus on the object without distraction. But then, of course, on the basis of a stable mind, we need to work on making our focus clear, that we can focus on the object clearly. This is clarity. So, of course, the fault there that we need to overcome is dullness, being very dull. And the technical word for that in the meditation text is usually laxity. So we need to develop these qualities in this order. First, we really need to learn to relax. Then we work on stabilizing the mind. Then we work on improving the clarity of our concentration. Now, what object should we focus on? And in the meditation text, the general advice is use the object that works best for you. And in the meditation text, usually it lists many different objects that are suitable. But usually in the meditation text, it says something like, if you're the sort of person who is highly discursive, always thinking, 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 then definitely the best object for you is the breath. And this, I think, accounts for probably 95% of the modern day population. We're all living in the head. So the breath is very much emphasized, I think, in just about all Buddhist traditions as a good object to use. And I think for many of us, this is probably going to be, at least as a beginning stage, the best object to use. Because many of us in our modern society, again, we're all living in the head, always thinking, thinking, conceptualizing, compulsive, obsessive thinking. So much so that we've lost touch with physical reality, especially our own body. And so the physical sensations of the breath, of course, by focusing on them, they help us to get out of the head and into the body. And most of our conceptual thinking is about the past and the future. In fact, very rarely are we in the present moment. And of course, according to Buddhism, if we're dwelling in the past or jumping into the future all the time, that's really going to cause a lot of unhappiness in us. And even some modern studies have shown this to be the case as well, that living in the past and the future is a cause for unhappiness. So the breath, of course, the physical sensations of the breath only happen in the present moment. So by focusing on them, not only do we get out of the head and into the body, but we get out of the past and the future into the present moment. So I think for many of us, this is probably going to be the best object to use. And also within the breath practice, there are at least three variations of that practice that are very suitable for developing these three qualities. The first variation is sometimes called the full body, which is that we simply focus on sensations anywhere in the body related to our breathing in a very diffuse way. And this practice is very good or very helpful in terms of relaxation. And particularly with this practice, if we have a very tense body, then we can, with this practice, lie down in the corpse posture, Shavasana posture, flat on our back, hands a bit to the side, relaxing the body as much as we can, and then just focusing very gently on the sensations of the breath anywhere in the body as we breathe. Really, on particularly on every out-breath, relaxing, relaxing, relaxing. So this practice can be very good to help us to develop this relaxation. The second variation is to focus on the area of the abdomen, the rising and lowering of the abdomen as we breathe. Now, because this is a very large object, it's quite easy to focus on this. So this practice of focusing on the abdomen, which is emphasized in quite a number of traditions, Buddhist traditions, is very good for stability, to stabilize the mind, because it's something relatively easy to focus on. Then we have another variation of focusing at the nostrils. And with the nostrils, of course, this is a very much smaller object. And to pick up the sensations in this very small area, that forces us to make our mind more clear so we can pick them up. So this nostrils practice is good for improving clarity. So we can use these variations of the practice depending on at what stage we are in our practice. Also, the nostrils has another big advantage. And those of you who've used the nostrils before may realize this already, is when we're focusing here on the sensations of the breath and our mind calms down and we get more focused, what you've probably noticed, of course, is your breathing gets very, very subtle. Sometimes even to the point where it hardly feels like you're breathing at all. And of course, if your breath is so subtle, the sensations here become more subtle, which forces us to be more clear. Equally well, if our mind gets a bit agitated, our breathing becomes more coarse, which means the sensations here get easier to detect, which helps us to avoid distraction. So we have this sort of biofeedback loop happening here to help not only improve clarity, but to help us to avoid becoming distracted. So these are the three variations of the breath practice, and I think for many of us, this is probably going to be the best place to start. What I'd like to do now is mention two more objects that I think can be very helpful and beneficial in our modern day society. And particularly these two objects can be also a very good bridge into the Vipassana practice as well. And so since we're talking about the emptiness practice, Vipassana practice, I think these two objects can also be very relevant here. And so the second object that we can focus on is to focus on the mind itself. And this has also a lot of immediate advantages. And again, in our modern society, we really tend to be the slaves of our mind, meaning that we always tend to get caught up in our thoughts, emotions, and memories, that whenever something comes up, we identify with it, we follow it, we get caught up in our stories. And often a lot of this mental content is quite negative, and we often get overwhelmed by it. And then, of course, when a lot of this negative stuff comes up, thoughts, emotions, memories, we often don't know how to deal with it effectively. So what we often try to do is we try and stuff it back down. We try to suppress it. And of course, suppressing these things doesn't deal with them. All that happens is that they often manifest as physical problems. I think a lot of physical illness these days is simply because of suppressing negative mental events. And also, of course, what we tend to do is we project a lot of this negativity onto the people around us because we sort of disowned it. We can sort of feel that negativity there, but it's not me. It must be them. They're the ones who are angry, not me. So we tend to project a lot of this onto others. And of course, in psychology, this is often called the shadow. So this practice of focusing on the mind as the object of shamatha practice can be very helpful for this. Is in this practice, what we are doing, of course, is simply observing our own mind and whatever appears in the mind, thoughts, emotions, memories, without getting caught up in them, without trying to get rid of them or suppress them. We are simply developing the ability to be the observer or the witness, observing these mental events arising and passing, arising and passing. Because now what we do, of course, is when something comes up, we identify with it, we follow it. And of course, every time we do that, we feed it, which means the habit of all this mental junk coming up will get stronger and stronger and stronger. And of course, if it's a negative mental event, we don't like it, we don't know what to do with it, and we suppress it, we're also feeding it. Whereas in this shamatha practice of observing the mind and all the mental events arising and passing, every time we can manage to observe it arise and pass, of course we're not feeding it. And if we don't feed it and we allow it to arise and pass, the habit of this mental junk coming up will get weaker and weaker and weaker. Our mind will naturally become more still. And also, of course, by developing this capacity to be the observer or the witness and to not get caught up in these things, it means not only will our mind naturally become more still, but if some strong negative event were to arise in our mind, we could simply be with it and not get overwhelmed by it. Simply observe it arise and pass. We can only get overwhelmed by these things if we identify with them or we try to suppress them. Because actually, if we look at a thought, emotion, or memory, I mean, virtually it's nothing. There's nothing to it. We just give it power by identifying with it and following it or trying to push it away and suppress it. If we just observe it, it can't do anything to us. So we will really become the masters of our mind. So this practice is very good for this because, again, I think many of us really are the slaves of our mind, really overwhelmed by all of these things. And of course, if these negative events, negative memories, negative things that come up, if we can simply observe them and pass, we are of course acknowledging them. And what you find is this can be a very healing practice as well. Because a lot of our problems we have now is things that we've suppressed since early childhood that are really creating a lot of problems with us now. And what you will find is that simply watching, allowing them to come up and simply acknowledging them and watching them arise and pass often can really let go of them. And it's a very, very healing practice as well. So I think for this reason, these reasons, looking at the mind, using the mind as the object of shamatha practice can be very, very beneficial for many of us. But of course, the reality is that it tends not to be as easy as the breath because, of course, the breath is physical, tangible. The mind is not. And many of us have such a strong habit of automatically following or suppressing. And so many people who try to do this practice just constantly get swept away all the time. But again, there are enormous benefits with this practice. So if we feel that it can bring benefit, we just need to be patient and keep doing the practice. And then we can follow Shantideva's advice, great Indian master, who says, no matter how difficult something appears to be, everything with practice becomes easy. So all we need to do is practice. All we need to do is to change our habit of not getting caught up, but simply observing these mental events. And even just doing this, particularly when the mind becomes very still and quiet, we end up in this very open, spacious state. We start to see this clarity of mind. And this, if we are intuitive enough, can actually help us to lead into realizing the ultimate nature of the mind. So it can be a very good bridge into the Vipassana practice in terms of realizing the nature of the mind. Even more so than that, we have the third practice. Which is shamatha with no object. Sometimes this is called awareness of awareness. And in this practice, what we are simply doing is resting in awareness itself, which in a couple of the meditations we've done, I've tried to do a little bit of at the end of the meditation, just to get a little bit of a taste of that practice. So the difference between the second and the third practice is that in the second practice, there is this sort of sense of being the observer and the witness, looking at the mind and whatever arises in the mind. Whereas in the third practice, it's not so much looking at the mind, rather than being the mind. And in the third practice, we're not particularly interested in any appearances. Of course, all sorts of things will continue to arise in the mind, but in the third practice, we're not looking at them. Of course, we're not trying to get rid of them, but we're not just not interested in them. We're just resting in that space of the mind itself, the awareness itself, from which all of these appearances emerge. So we're just resting in that, focusing on that itself. And this experientially is a much more non-dualistic practice. In that third practice, there's not really a strong sense of being the observer or the witness. It's more like being the mind itself. And because of that, and resting in awareness itself, this practice in particular can be a very good bridge into the Vipassana practice. By simply resting in the clear and knowing nature of the mind, this can lead us intuitively more into realizing the ultimate nature of the mind, the emptiness of the mind. And what we're going to do now is have a look at this practice based on a chart in your handout here, this shamatha chart. And what we can see in the shamatha chart is there are 9 steps or stages in our practice towards shamatha in that picture. And we're going to have a look at that very shortly. But I'll just read on again from Alan Wallace what he recommends in terms of what object to use for shamatha practice. And this is on page 6. And he says, to guide meditators through these 10 stages, so the 10 stages are these 9 steps plus the result, shamatha, he says, I have chosen from Buddhist teachings 3 techniques that I have found effective for people in the modern world. These 3 techniques are the basis for the 3 divisions of this book. For the first 4 stages, you should practice whatever method you find easiest. By stage 5, the mind is relatively stable and you can move on to subtler techniques. For achieving the first 4 stages, I recommend the practice of mindfulness of breathing, variations of which can be found in Zen, Vipassana, and Tibetan Buddhism. Mindfulness of breathing means settling your awareness on the sensations involved in breathing, continually returning your attention there whenever your mind wanders. Beginning with the fifth stage, I recommend a method called settling the mind in its natural state. So that's what he calls the second practice, observing the mind. He calls it settling the mind in its natural state. In this technique, you direct your attention to mental experiences, all the events, that is, thoughts, mental images and emotions that arise in the domain of the mind. This method is drawn from the Dzogchen or Great Perfection lineage, but is found in other Buddhist traditions as well. With the instructions for the eighth attentional stage onward, we move on to a subtler, still subtler practice of maintaining awareness of awareness itself, the third practice here. The technique is also is called shamatha without an object. Here the practice is not so much one of developing attentional stability and vividness as it is of discovering the stillness and luminosity inherent in awareness itself. The training in mindfulness of breathing may be helpful to anyone, including those seeking to prevent or treat attention deficit hyperactivity disorders. Many people find the second practice, that of settling the mind in its natural state, to be more challenging, but some meditators take to it naturally. Likewise, the practice of awareness is subtler still, but it may be optimal from the beginning for those who are strongly drawn to it. You may use any one of the three methods to progress along all 10 stages of attentional development, or you may follow the sequence described in this book. How fast you progress will depend on the level of your commitment and the degree to which your lifestyle and environment support such practice. Sometimes in the meditation texts, they also say that, you know, if your mind is very much chaotic and distracted, and even the breath is sort of too difficult, they say as a very starting point, is to pick a physical object such as a stick or a pebble, put it in front of you and just look at it and use that as your object. But only use it as long as we start to develop some relaxation and a little bit of stability, and then switch to a more subtle object like the mental image of that stick or pebble in the mind. Because actually, as we move along the steps to shamatha, and as our concentration increases, improves, our sense faculties slowly start to shut down. Meaning that even if we're using the sensations of the breath as a beginning point of the practice, at a certain stage along this practice, we'll need to switch to a mental object. How we do that, I'll talk about a little bit later. So that's a little bit some recommended objects. So again, the general recommendation is pick the object that works best for you, but I probably would suggest that for most of us, the breath is probably going to be the best place at least to start. Any questions about anything so far? Because now we're going to look at this diagram and chart here on this handout. Oh, we can aim at. As Alan Wallace there mentioned, that depends on your commitment and to the lifestyle that supports your practice. As we're going to see, to actually achieve shamatha, of course, would involve a huge commitment. And then often people go, well, that's not possible for me, so I won't even bother. I think this would be a big mistake, because whatever level of commitment and effort we put into the practice, that much benefit we will get out of the practice. So even if we manage only to get a few stages up the path of these nine, I think we will notice a quite a dramatic improvement in our life. You know, we'll be more calm, we'll be more focused, less mental afflictions, less stress, more effective in everything we do. I mean, we will notice quite substantial improvement in our life. But what we need to understand, and this is very much spoken about in the meditation texts, is we need to make sure that we have this sort of supportive lifestyle. Now, of course, in the modern day, meditation has got quite popular, particularly this mindfulness meditation, because, you know, our minds are really chaotic and neurotic and, I mean, really getting more and more out of control. And so people really are seeing that they need to do something about their mind, you know. And so they're turning more and more to meditation. And unfortunately, what's happening is for a lot of people, they're trying to use a little bit of mindfulness meditation to sort of soothe this agitation. And yet the rest of the day they continue on their neurotic ways, getting caught up in all this distractions and things. And then they wonder why the meditation's not working. You know, they're doing 15 minutes or 30 minutes of calming in the morning, and then they run around for 15 hours like a mad person, getting overwhelmed and getting caught up on the iPhones and emails and Facebook and bombarded by stimulus. So, of course, 15 minutes of that versus 15 hours of, I mean, what's going to sort of win out? So, you know, then meditation becomes like a little band-aid, which doesn't really work so well. So if we want this practice to work, whatever level of commitment we can manage, we need to fix up our lifestyle, because otherwise nothing's going to change. So we need to really work on that supportive lifestyle. And particular, an integral part of that, of course, is to strengthen the mindfulness, which is what we're going to talk about next, is the main tool in this practice is mindfulness. It's one of these mental factors that I briefly mentioned earlier. The mental factor of mindfulness is the ability to hold an object, to remember an object without becoming distracted. So, of course, in our meditation, we are strengthening that by continually focusing on the object as much as we can. Then, for the rest of the day, we need to keep working on that mindfulness as well. So that's got to be part of the supportive lifestyle. So I'll speak more about that coming up. But now, as I mentioned, that there's two main tools in this practice, which actually you can see in the diagram, which we're going to be looking at now in some detail. Down the bottom of the diagram, we see the meditator right down the bottom. And in their hand, in the left hand is a rope, and in the right hand is a hook. So these are the two main tools in this practice. The rope in the left hand is the rope of mindfulness. So mindfulness is this ability to be able to focus and hold an object without becoming distracted. And mindfulness in Sanskrit is smriti, in Pali it's sati. And these words literally mean to remember, to remember. So it means to remember the object, to not become distracted. Now, the word mindfulness in a lot of modern day traditions is used in a slightly different way. In a lot of modern traditions now, the word mindfulness is often referred to as this non-judgmental awareness of whatever is arising in the present moment. Of course, this is a very good thing to do, but this is not really how mindfulness was defined in the original Buddhist texts, whether we're talking Theravada or Mahayana, is that mindfulness was this ability simply to remember the object, to be able to hold or focus the object without becoming distracted. The second tool, which in the right hand is this hook, is symbolizing what's called introspection. And introspection is like the monitor. Introspection is like a little spy in the corner of the mind that is monitoring how is our mindfulness going. Are we starting to become distracted? Are we starting to become dull? So it's like quality control, monitoring our focus. Is it going well or not? And so that's why symbolizing the hook is that introspection's job is to notice that if we've become distracted or dull, and then to bring the mind back, to sort of hook the mind back. So we have the hook symbolizing that introspection. So these are the two main tools we use in the practice. So let's have a look at the practice in a little bit more detail. If we look at the top of the second page of the shamatha section, it says shamatha is attained by progressing through the 9 stages, relying on the 8 antidotes to abandon the 5 faults. So we progress through these 9 stages by using these antidotes to overcome the faults in the practice. And here in the table, we see that the first fault is laziness. Now, and the first antidote to that is faith. Now, like everything in daily life, if we see no benefit in something, we're not going to put much effort into it. We're going to be pretty lazy when it comes to that activity if we see no benefit. What's the point in doing it? So likewise here, often people tend to be very lazy when it comes to meditation or shamatha practice because they don't really realize the benefits. Maybe they're just doing the practice because someone told them they should do it. And then we'll be very lazy when it comes to the practice. So if we're lazy when it comes to our shamatha practice or meditation in general, what we need to do is to reflect on the practice, understand what it is and what benefits we're going to get from the practice. And this shamatha practice is going to bring enormous benefits. Because by developing a relaxed, stable and clear mind, then of course we're going to be much more effective in everything we do in our life. Our mind will be more peaceful, more calm, less mental afflictions, less stress. And instead of being the slaves of our mind, we're going to become the masters of our mind. And then, of course, if we really develop a stable, clear, focused mind, then everything we do becomes much more effective. All of our other meditation practices become much more effective. And our Vipassana practice will be able to penetrate the nature of reality deeper and deeper, and thereby begin to overcome all of our mental afflictions and suffering. So if we really reflect on these benefits of the practice, then we're going to have the first antidote, faith. Faith here means faith in the practice, faith that this practice is going to bring me a lot of benefit. And if we have faith in the practice, that will lead to the second antidote, aspiration. We'll have a lot of aspiration to do the practice, which of course will lead to the third antidote. We'll put effort into the practice. And then slowly, slowly, as our practice improves, we're going to have the fourth antidote, pliancy. Pliancy is like flexibility or serviceability of body and mind. Now, of course, our mind has a lot of resistance to practice, and our body often creates a lot of pains and obstacles to our meditation. But as we progress in the shamatha practice, our mind, both our body and mind, will become more flexible, more serviceable, less resistance, less obstacle. And so then this is going to be the final antidote to laziness, that with a flexible and serviceable body and mind, we will be able to turn our mind to anything we want, without any problem, without any resistance or laziness. The second fault here is forgetfulness. And forgetfulness here can mean forgetting the instructions, forgetting what to do, but also, of course, forgetting the object. So, of course, the antidote here is mindfulness. Mindfulness is to remember the object, to hold the object. The third fault is these two imbalances we talked about of laxity and excitement, or dullness and distraction. So these are the two main imbalances in our practice. And so again, it's introspection's job to notice if we are becoming dull or distracted. So that's the fault, the antidote here, is introspection. Introspection is to notice if we're becoming dull or distracted, and then we reapply our mindfulness to the object. The fourth fault here is non-application. Non-application means that we've identified this problem, that we've become dull or distracted, but we don't do anything about it. That's a fault. So, of course, the antidote is application, which means fix the fault, do something. If you become distracted, come back to the object. If you're becoming dull, sharpen your focus. And then there's a fifth fault, which, as a beginner, doesn't tend to be a big problem. Over-application. Over-application means that we are focusing well on the object, but we keep adjusting our focus unnecessarily. And of course, the antidote to that is equanimity. So here the word equanimity means balance, means basically leave the mind as it is, because it's okay. So of course, the saying here is, if it's not broken, don't fix it. But again, for us as beginners, our mind tends to be broken pretty often. So we need to keep fixing it. So this over-application only becomes a bit of an issue as we progress and our focus becomes very good. At that time, if we keep adjusting the focus unnecessarily, that becomes a bit of a problem. That's what over-application means. So let's have a look. Oh, anything with that chart that's not clear first? Because I want to go now to the diagram on the left. Start to have a look at that.
Policing myself or whatever you say in order to, you know, all the time be, and then, like, you know, it's a point of just waiting for the gong already, because it's just there is, like, you know, and then the body starts to hurt, and this point is just like, it's frustrated.
Yeah.
And like, meditation in this course are longer, so it's like,
So this frustration, of course, comes from expectation. See, and that's what we're going to see at the first stage of practice here. The first stage of practice is usually characterized by seeing that our mind is completely out of control. So if we look at that first diagram, we see that the elephant, which is the mind, and the blackness in the elephant is this dullness. The monkey is conceptual thought in general, and the black is this excitement. So at the first stage of practice here, which is called setting the mind, we see that the elephant and monkey are running wildly ahead of us, symbolizing the fact that at the first stage of practice, what we notice is that our mind is completely out of control. And so what people do, of course, is that when they go into practice, they have this expectation. They think, you know, my mind's not too bad. Okay, sometimes I get distracted and dull, but I think I should be able to focus on the breath okay. You know, not too bad.
Oh, I know. What you're talking about, concentration, whatever, disorder.
Oh, okay.
So I have it, I know. I got the okay for that. But the question is, like...
Yeah, so... So therefore, what happens at this first stage is that often people try to focus on the breath, we use the breath as example, and then they notice within, like, usually 3 or 4 seconds, gone completely. And then usually it takes many minutes later, so finally introspection goes, hang on, I'm not on the breath anymore. And then mindfulness grabs the breath again. And then another 2 or 3 seconds later, we're gone again. And then another 3 or 4 minutes later, introspection says, oh, actually, I'm supposed to be on the breath, aren't I? And we go back to the breath. So this is the first stage. And then, of course, when people have this experience, they go, oh, I can't meditate. I just can't meditate. In fact, it's worse than that, because I must be doing something wrong, because since I started to meditate, my mind has got worse. My mind is definitely more out of control now since I've been meditating than before I started meditating. In fact, it's worse than that, because, you know, then people open their eyes and look around and everyone is super still in the class. I'm the only one who can't meditate in this class. Everyone else is perfect. They're so still, focused. I'm a disaster. So if this is your experience, you can meditate. You've made it to step one. So this is actually a sign of progress. And I'm not joking, I'm serious. This is a sign of progress because we are realizing for the very first time in our life how out of control our mind really is. Because before we started meditating, we were always out distracted, looking outwards. We're never looking inwards. And it's only when we have to look at the mind and see what it's doing, we see it's completely out of control. So if this is your experience, you can meditate, you're making progress, you made it to step one. So again, what we need to do to avoid unnecessary frustration is to get rid of these expectations. We have completely unrealistic expectations. So in any practice, if you begin the practice with some sort of expectation, you're setting yourself up for a lot of frustration unnecessarily. So at the beginning of the meditation, if you notice any expectation, drop it immediately. Otherwise, you're going to have all sorts of difficulties. Because often people, and we'll finish on this note, often people, you know, people discussing to other people about meditation, you know, often people hear people say, oh, I had a really good meditation today. My mind was really still and focused. Or another person says, oh, I had a terrible meditation today. My mind was all over the place. If this is our idea of good and bad meditation, we're stuck in the hope-fear cycle, the expectation cycle. We're not going to go anywhere. Because from one day to the next, we don't know what our mind is going to do. Some days it's naturally more quiet. Other days it's naturally more active. So then what is a good and bad meditation? A good meditation is simply any meditation where we, to the best of our ability, have tried to follow the instructions, no matter what happens. And a bad meditation is where we sit down and we don't try to follow the instructions, we just let the mind do whatever it wants. So if we have this idea, then I think we'll avoid any of this unnecessary frustration. Because another expectation that people have, you know, let's say that they've been meditating a few weeks and after a couple of weeks their mind, they've noticed some improvement. Then the following week comes along, they think, okay, this week it's got to be at least the same, if not better. And of course, often it goes downhill and then they go, oh, what's happening? It was going well and now it's not. And again, I don't know anyone whose meditation practice goes like this. Generally, they go like this. But over the long term, there is some improvement. But if we try to measure improvement in short term over days or weeks, you're just going to set yourself up for a lot of frustration. So just let go of that, let go of that, let go of that. And just, again, try the best you can to follow the instructions. And then be happy with that, no matter what happens. Again, Shanti Deva's advice, no matter how difficult something is, everything with practice becomes easy. So all we got to do is practice, practice, practice. We've run over time, so let's stop there. Of course, there's a lot more to be said about these 9 stages, and I'm going to continue that tomorrow morning. But let's have a break there, and then meditation with Jonas at 5:15. And I'll see you tomorrow morning.